I was concentrating on getting a pathway cleared so we could walk in and wasn't so much worried about what's on the walls. She turned back to me. Anything on that one we found in the blanket? I haven't pursued it just yet, but there are at least two museums here in the state with which he was in correspondence, so I guess I'll start there. I continued eating and unscrewed a bottle of water she'd provided and took a swig. Any sign of a will? She smiled. There was an envelope in his personal file that had a piece of notebook paper in it from 1994, not notarized, leaving all his worldly possessions to one Bass Townsend. And who, pray tell, is Bass Townsend? That is a very good question. Vic made a face. So if we don't find somebody to give this money to, who gets it? The federal government. I turned back to Carol. Any word from the tax folks over in Sheridan? They want to know which institution has the money.
I bet they do.
What, they're worried that a Wyoming sheriff is driving around with $1 million in a shoebox? Something like that. The Bank of Durant, right down the street here. Security box for Charlie Lee?
Yes. Well, I think yes.
I'll go have a talk with Vern Selby and see if I can't get a warrant. I looked back up at the painting. What do you do with the personal items if there isn't anyone to forward them to? Generally, we keep any artifacts for the museum display in the day room and just donate the things that aren't of much value, but with these paintings and books, especially the military history and art, I don't know what we're going to do. There's a ton of books on Custer and the Little Bighorn. Vic chimed in. I hope they're better than the movies. Carol looked at me. We caught a really bad double feature at the Red Pony last night. I glanced out the door. Did you see all the notes in the margins of the books? Carol sighed. I did. I pulled all the pieces of paper from them, but I don't know what to make of all those notes. We need somebody who knows something about art to go through them. Any ideas? The closest would be the Brinton over in Bighorn. I glanced out the door again at the tall stacks of books, and at the bathroom where even more books sat on top of the toilet. Good thing you've got a hand truck. I listened as the judge imitated the banker. It'll have to go through probate. That'll take months, if not years.
Possibly.
I glanced around the chambers of His Honor, Vern Selby. If you don't mind my asking, Walter, what are you looking for? A copy of Bleak House to throw at you. He nodded.
That might hurt. As I recall, it is a long book.
There isn't anybody, Vern. No relations, contacts, nothing. Just a handwritten will, leaving all his worldly belongings to a Bass Townsend.
Well, that's inconvenient.
And it's $1 million.
Expensively inconvenient.
I don't think we've ever had anything like this happen in the county before. He leaned back in his weathered leather chair and glanced down Main Street from his second-story window. We've had large estates that were liquidated, private assets, but usually there's someone who comes forward. I'm assuming that a public announcement will be made in the Current today, along with the obituary.
Well, perhaps someone will come forward with some information.
And if they don't? He straightened his mustache in a very cinematic Clifton Webb way and then spread his hand. The coffers of the state and nation will be replenished, along with a bunch of lawyers. Jarndyce and Jarndyce. He turned back to study me, and I led him for a good long while.
How are you doing, Walter?
Annoyed.
More than usual?
Meaning? He studied me with the pale, patient blue eyes. There's been talk that you've been more distracted and agitated than usual.
From whom?
He waved in a vague sort of way. Just general talk. Repositioning myself in his chair, I thought about it. Well, I'm still getting over some of the physical damage from Mexico. I only talk to my daughter once a week if she can tolerate it. And I'm not so sure I like being a sheriff anymore. I think that about covers it. He nodded.
Still have your dog?
I do.
Good. Always good to have a dog.
Maybe it's time, Vern.
Possibly.
He leaned forward and rested his arms on his desk. I understand the Basque contingency has been in contact with your deputy, the young man, Sizer Pretoria.
Yep, he talked with me about it. That's good, that's good.
He's a capable young man.
Yes, but is he sheriff material?
I think so. What does he have to say about standing for sheriff? I laughed. Mostly he wants to know if I'm stepping down.
And are you? I haven't made up my mind yet. There was a long pause. What would you do with yourself, Walter? I stood, sliding my chair back into position beside the other one, and looking around at the old barrister bookcases. I don't know. Maybe head up to Fort McKinney and wave at cars. It affects you, going up there, doesn't it? It does. I don't hardly ever remember Lucien Connolly going up there at all. He doesn't. Ever? Ever. I suppose we all deal with mortality in our own way. He glanced up at me. Do you still play chess with him at the home for assisted living? The old folks' home, he calls it. Tonight, yeah. How's he doing? I walked over to the bookcases and stared at the perfectly uniformed tomes, tan with maroon stripes, like soldiers on parade. Not as sharp, and he doesn't get out that much, which I suppose is my fault. I should go up there. There was a pause as he thought about it, and the room seemed to grow smaller. But you and I both know I won't. Staring at my reflection in the glass, I watched my lips tighten. No, Vern, probably not.
You keep leading with that queen and you're going to get your ass kicked.
It's my queen or my ass. Lucien Connolly retrieved his tumbler from the small table to our left, sipped his Pappy Van Winkle's Family Reserve, and licked his lips so as not to lose a drop.
Yes, it is.
Are we celebrating something? He lifted his glass.
June 6, 1944.
That was last week. He continued to hold his glass out to me. I nodded and touched the rim of mine to the old Doolittle Raiders. D-Day. He studied me.
Any dates you recollect from that war of yours?
January 30th, 1968. He looked at me, puzzled. Tet offensive. He angled a knight toward the border.
Any good dates?
I mustered out August 3rd, 1972. And thought about it. I've got a question for you.
Shoot.
Do you remember the day your plane got shot down?
I remember the minute.
The day you were captured by the Japanese?
Yep, why?
George Orwell used to say that the English people do not retain among their historical memories the name of a single military victory.
Commie.
I laughed. In his own way, he fought a battle against totalitarianism that is as long-lasting as Churchill's against the language of fascism, at least. His dark eyes came up to mine.
What in the hell are you talking about?
Angling left, I took his bishop. Human nature, I mean, when you think about it. Hardly any of the epic poems or books are about victorious battles. The Iliad, The Charge of the Light Brigade, The Lost Battle, A Farewell to Arms, Drummer Hodge. He grunted.
In answer to your question, successful and prosperous cultures have the luxury of looking back at death and defeat with a sense of nostalgia, having won the overall war.
I moved my monarch after his rook. You don't think it's just a form of atonement for having participated in war in the first place?
Not if it was a good war.
Define the term good war.
The ones we won.
So Korea was not a good war?
That was a tie.
Pursuing with the queen, I noticed his knight lying in ambush.
The Indian Wars?
He studied me and then lifted his glass, taking a long, slow sip.
You mind if I ask where all this horse shit is coming from?
One of the residents up at the veterans' home passed away a couple of nights ago. Charlie Lee Silwater.
The colored fella?
Yep. Anyway, he had a lot of Custer books, and then there was one of the movies on at Henry's Bar last night with Robert Shaw, I believe. As expected, he brought out the knight.
My God, that one was horrible.
He made a face.
But not as bad as Ronald Reagan in Santa Fe Trail, where they had him as Jeb Stuart's goofy buddy in 1859, when everybody knows Custer didn't graduate from West Point until 1861.
I angled my queen away, my point being that the preoccupation with Custer... He touched his knight again and then settled on his king, sensing a danger.
Was personal propaganda is what it was. A brilliant campaign by a widowed wife, Libby Custer, was relentless.
Drawing on his distracted attention, I moved my own king back.
She assembled her husband into a shining example to American youth, turned him into a hero. Heroes are big business. Just look at all those ball-playing assholes on television selling shoes, soap, soup, and nuts.
Bringing my queen back, I tightened the noose. I don't follow.
In the later part of the 19th century, we were moving away from a community and regionally-based economy to a national one. Nationwide business is big business, and for that you needed an image, and men like Custer fit the bill. Hell, he was on cigars, soap, and posters. I even had a pedal car with his name on it when I was a kid.
What if the image was false? Ignoring the queen, he moved his king again.
Who's to say if the image was false?
He was actively engaging in genocide, Lucian.
Says who?
History. Nudging my queen forward, I announced, check. He looked disgusted. Either way, there's right and there's wrong.
Easy to say, sitting here playing chess in comfortable chairs and drinking my antiquarian bourbon.
I moved my queen again. Check. The old sheriff sighed.
I don't think he was as blundering an ass as he's portrayed, but in the heat of battle he made a dreadful miscalculation.
He reached out and toppled his king.
And for that, he paid the highest price that can be paid.
I lifted my glass. Remember the Alamo? He lifted his.
Amen, brother.
Chapter 3. It could either be a bad copy or a proof of some sort.
Proof of what?
No, just a proof, like an artist's study.
I watched as Barbara Schuster handled the canvas with white gloves in the conservation area of the Brinton Museum, carefully extracting it from waxed paper sleeves, and I felt bad about hauling the thing around rolled up in my jacket pocket. She reached up and adjusted a desk lamp with a circular fluorescent light and magnifying lens that was attached to the large table that dominated the room.
Well, from the action of the subjects, I would say that this is a study of a painting of a Western battle sometime in the mid to later part of the 19th century. The cavalryman is outfitted properly.
The Indian looks a little odd.
Yes. She lowered her glasses on her nose. Artists of that period, having never actually met an Indian, sometimes had some rather fanciful ideas as to their appearance. Many times the study would be done in an attempt to deal with problems involving light, color, form, perspective, composition,
costume.
Yes, that too.
He's kind of a combination of tribes, isn't he?
Yes, but like I said, a lot of times artists simply use their imagination, resulting in subjects that are somewhat far-fetched. But if this is a study for a larger work, then the final version might look completely different.
She flipped a toggle on the lamp, and I watched as it switched to a black light. So there's no way to tell who the artist might be or what piece of art this might have been a study from?
I'm afraid not.
She turned the canvas under the glow lamp again.
It's for a work in progress, and sometimes a great deal of the vitality of a piece of art can be gleaned from these types of studies, lending a fresh discovery or excitement to the work. It's almost like notes on how the artist became aware during the creation of the art, allowing us the opportunity to be a part of that creative process. But there would be no reason to sign it if that's the case.
There's no way this is a work of art unto itself.
Doubtful. I mean, if you look at the quality, you can see that the artist did this in something of a hurry and left out a great deal of detail, giving the impression that it is a work leading to an actual painting, if it was anyone of real repute. Folding her arms, she sat back on her stool. This was probably never meant to see the light of day.
What's it worth?
She stared at me. Excuse me?
What's it worth, a ballpark figure?
Her eyes went back to the square of canvas and crusty pigments. I'm no authority, and those types of financial assessments are usually made by experts in the field or people who can break up the molecular aspects of the paint or the canvas itself.
Just a basic idea.
Without any trace of the artist or history? I really can't say.
Is it worth a million?
A million what?
Dollars.
Goodness gracious, no.
He looked at me and laughed.
If you're planning on retiring on this, I'm afraid you're going to have to stick with being a sheriff.
I leaned in and looked down at it. So even if it was a prominent artist and a noteworthy painting, it wouldn't be worth that kind of money.
Well, if you were to, say, find one of Michelangelo's studies of the male model, of the Libyan Sibyl from the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel, it might be worth that much, but even then, you'd have a hard time certifying it.
Why?
The final rendering was female. Art changes and artists change their minds. She glanced at the painting again. And in all honesty, even though the artist is certainly capable, he or she was no Michelangelo.
I see. So, a couple $100?
At best.
Okay.
Do you mind if I ask what gave you the idea that it might be worth $1 million?
Just hazarding a guess.
I reached down and scooped the thing up along with the coverings.
You mind if I keep this stuff to protect it?
She stood. Not at all. And if you want a second opinion, we have a number of specialists in the field, appraisers who can perhaps determine the exact worth. Count von Lehmann, for one.
Count von Lehmann?
She smiled. More of our shirt-tailed Sheridan County royalty.
He's really a count?
Papal indulgence. He used to teach up in Bozeman and over at Sheridan College after he formally retired. She smiled. I once asked our conservationist, Larry Lowe, what kind of Count von Lehmann was, and he said, no count. But you might have him take a look at it. Last I heard, he was living over near Story in some strange house he built. I patted the packet surrounding the orphan art. Not for a couple $100, I don't think. Well, if you decide you want to hang it on the wall of your office, Larry can stretch it onto a frame for you. Old canvas can be awfully brittle.
I'll keep it in mind.
Pulling some of the books from a satchel on the stool beside me, I sat them on the counter. These are a few of the books he had. Any idea if they might be worth something? She examined the books, opening one and flipping through the pages. Harmson Collection, Volume 2, American Western Art, Visual Art of the Lakota, Early Illustrators of Western Art. There's some call for these, but not so much since they've been written in. She looked up at me. The owner?
Was.
Oh. From the notes in the books, would you say he was educated in art? She opened the book again and started reading.
Possibly.
If you want to leave some of them with me, I'll go through them and see what I can find.
You're sure that's not too much trouble?
Not at all. We took the elevator down to the ground floor, walking past the life-size display of Bradford Brinton.
The new digs are pretty amazing.
It's a long way from William Moncrief's original ranch house, huh? When did he sell the place to Brinton?
1923.
Before my time.
Mine, too.
She extended a hand when we stopped at the glass doors at the front of the relatively new museum. I'm sorry if this turned out to be a disappointment, Walter, but it's a bit of unusual excitement, I suppose.
The actual owner passed away over in Durant at the veteran's home, and I thought we should get a general idea of what it's worth.
Still not your usual line of work. I placed the art under my arm and extended a hand.
Nope.
She took my hand and we shook.
Well, if I can be of any further assistance at all, don't hesitate.
I won't, and thank you again. Heading out the door, I looked toward the edge of the parking lot where Vic sat on a bench watching Dog, who was standing in Little Goose Creek. Walking down the stairs, I angled toward the two and stopped beside her, placing my hands on my hips.
Did you let Dog go swimming?
It was his idea. She didn't move, her head lying back with the sunglasses covering her eyes, reflecting the intermittent sunshine that sparked through the thick-leaved cottonwood trees. I guess he needed cooling off, or he decided to go fishing.
The inside of my truck is now going to smell like wet dog.
I glanced around at the beautifully sculpted grounds near the little town of Bighorn in neighboring Sheridan County.
You missed a beautiful museum.
Yeah, I just don't like museums that much. I spent my whole childhood back in Philadelphia, going to museums and, of course, visiting the Liberty Bell.
See the bell a lot?
Every school year since sixth grade. We're on a first-name basis. She stretched her legs out and crossed her boots as Dog dipped his head and gulped a gallon or two. I don't know what the big deal is. I mean, it's got a crack in it.
So I've heard.
What do they say about your painting?
A couple of $100 at best.
Her eyes went back to Dog. Sell it to him and we'll go have lunch.
I don't think they want it.
Too bad. She stood and stretched, her uniform shirt coming loose and revealing her lean torso. So who is this Bradford Brinton guy?
Born in Illinois, Brinton got a degree from Yale and went into business with his old man as vice president of the Great Detour Plow Company, which merged with
J.I. Case threshing machines.
Case as in the Case?
Yep. He enlisted and took part in the Meuse-Argonne and some offensives in World War I and bought this ranch in 1923. He was married and had two daughters and died in Miami, Florida in 1936 of acute pancreatitis when he was 56. I glanced around. He left the ranch to his sister, and she used it as a summer home until 1960, when she turned it and the artistic contents over to the Northern Trust of Chicago, who administered it as the Bradford Brinton Museum. She peered down the creek as Dog ambled across the bank and looked up at us. "And that's the ranch house down there that we drove by?"
"Yep."
"What's the other one farther down?"
"From what I'm to understand, his whoopee house."
"Whoopee house?"
"He sometimes had women and liquor brought in."
"You cowboys." Shaking her head, she turned and looked back at the state-of-the-art $16 million museum as Dog drew closer.
"And who built that?"
"Forrest E. Mars, Jr."
"And who is Forrest E. Mars, Jr.?"
Dog began shaking, filling the air with droplets that coated us. "Have you ever eaten a Mars bar, Milky Way, or a bag of M&Ms?" She wiped off her glasses with a shirt tail.
"Sure."
"Then in some small way you helped foot the bill for that museum."
"Mars as in Mars."
We started back for my truck with Dog in tow.
"So Sheridan County is the main line of Wyoming?"
"In what way?"
"Old money."
I thought about it.
"I guess so."
I looked out over Lake Desmet, the 3,000-acre body of water that runs along the Bozeman Trail at the base of the Bighorn Mountains, but I couldn't see it, even though I felt as if I were floating on it. Someone was talking to me, but I couldn't seem to respond. It was as if I opened my mouth, I might drown.
"Maybe he won the lottery."
I jerked my mind back in hopes that she might not have noticed its absence.
"What?"
She glanced at her wristwatch.
"That was a short one, only 3 minutes. Maybe you are getting better."
I sipped my iced tea, but said nothing. She gazed out at the small waves being decapitated by the wind.
"Who the hell knows? Maybe old Charlie Lee just invested wisely."
I rested the iced tea back on the table. "And the books and partial painting don't really mean anything?
I'm just saying there may not be any mystery to all this."
She looked out the lake stop windows at the restless water. "It seems like you want there to be." I shrugged. "I just want that $1 million to go to the right person. And I'd like to know where it came from."
"Not your job."
"What's that supposed to mean?"
"That's what we have lawyers and bankers for, not to mention the IRS.
"I'm trying to help them along." "You're trying to do their job, which is why you're pissing them off."
"I'm not pissing anybody off."
There was a disturbance on the deck as a mother and father bickered, their voices rising.
"Then where's your warrant?"
I shrugged. "I'm working on it." She sipped her Diet Coke, but then turned and gazed at me.
"What did Vern Selby say?"
I gestured out the window. "He basically told me to go jump in said lake." She turned, self-satisfied, as we both studied the landscape past the combative parents. Our food arrived, and we sat there eating, relatively silent, staring through the glass at a few of the other tourists seated on the deck outside, their children making bright noises and racing about like barn swallows.
"Is having kids overrated?"
I was surprised by the question, but quickly recovered before stuffing more pork carnitas into my mouth. "It has its moments, kind of like a tornado that goes on in your life for 20 years. She took a fry from her plate and popped it into her mouth.
"Sounds like fun."
I chewed and thought about it as we watched the argument outside become even more heated. I was about to turn away when the woman, having waited until the man had gone to the railing to say something to the children below, looked directly at me and mouthed two words, "Help me."
"Heard from your daughter lately?"
A long moment passed as the man returned and leaned in toward whom I assumed was his wife. "No, I guess she's busy."
"Yeah."
He was quick
and we could hear the report of the blow as he smacked her, her face turning as she lifted a hand of her own to cover up, then turning to look at him in shock. I was already off my stool when the woman stood and backed away to the left, turning and running into the building and disappearing into the bathroom. Vic was standing to my left as I started off.
"I'll check on her."
I said nothing, but continued toward the end of the bar and took a left, pushing through the glass doors and moving toward the umbrella-covered table where the angry man sat watching the two kids playing in the sandbox below the deck. "Excuse me?" He turned, and his eyes blinked only once. "Could I see some identification, please?" He continued to stare at me. Pulling my light jacket back, I revealed my star and kept very strong eye contact with him. "I need to see some ID right now." Nodding a response, he hunched up and removed his wallet from his back pocket and flipped it open, pulling out a license and handing it to me with as much indifference as he could muster. But in the action, his jacket gaped, and I could make out a snub-nosed revolver tucked into his belt. Continuing to watch him, I glanced at the card and read, "Mr. Dean Gibson, San Jose, California." "Yeah?" I glanced back and could see Vic returning with the woman, a hand on her arm. "Do you mind coming with me for a moment?" He shook his head. "I'm not leaving my kids out here." As the two women arrived, I gestured toward the red-eyed one who had mouthed the words to me through the picture window. "Is this your wife, Mr. Gibson?" He glared at her, but she wouldn't look at him.